Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. And this hour, we're talking about beer with Tim Nelson. He shares his plans for Earth Rider Brewing Company in Superior. Plus, we'll hear from South Shore Brewery's Bo Bellinger about his love for craft brewing. But first, Tim Nelson shares a little bit about his background and how he made beer his business in the mid-90s.
I started initially in 1994, writing a business plan to do a brewery in Duluth, and that eventually became Fitger's Brewhouse that opened in 1995. And the reason was is I had gone to school in the Twin Ports, and I wanted to move back to the area after grad school, and figured out that the best way to do that would be to make my own way. And beer was having a bit of a moment in the mid-90s, and it's actually on the backside of business activity, new openings. And so we opened in 95, and I came back to the Twin Ports to do that endeavor, and it ended up evolving into a brew pub rather than a straight brewery. And we were able to do a lot of cool things for 20 years that I owned it.
Well, and you were one of the first five in the state of Minnesota, right?
Yeah, we were that are still operating at least. Two of them were in Duluth, Lake Superior Brewing and us, Summit, Shells, and Rock Bottom Brewery. So, yeah, we were it. And a couple years later, we started the Minnesota Craft Brewers Guild. Yeah, and then just watched the growth start to happen around 2005, maybe. It started to really take off again, the industry.
So why do you think it's become so popular since then?
I think it's the relocalization of the desire to relocalize our food production and just what we buy, the craft culture. You know, people are drawn to things that are made in their communities. As far as beer goes, they like to know the brewers. They like to know that what they're doing is supporting a community. And breweries really seem to fill that niche of a gathering place and something to rally behind, much like a local sports team. People really root for their local college or professional team, and breweries are kind of the same way. They're able to create cultural activities and places for people to gather and congregate, and they seem like they're real neutral areas that everybody can agree over a beer. That's one point we can all agree on, is beer is good. And from there, we can have a real insightful conversations and gives us some latitude to express ourselves artistically in the beer, but also promote some music or whatever kind of artistic endeavors that are happening.
And so over the years, of all the brews that you made, have you had a favorite?
The beers. There's been so many.
Any that stick out in your mind?
Yeah, well, it's been kind of interesting to watch the whole progression of what the public enjoys. And when I first started, it was more English styles, maltier beers, big stouts and porters, and extra special bitters. And now, of course, India Pale Ales have really come on and end up being 60% of the craft market in the country. So more bitter, big, strong ales have been all the rage for the last few years. And now we're watching sour beers come in and some lighter lagers, craft-made lagers that are gaining popularity. So my favorites, I love a great Pilsner. I love a really good IPA. I like a good pale ale. I like stouts. I like porters. I like sours. So I don't have one. I do mostly. if it's too malty or too sweet, it's not my thing.
Okay.
I'm more savory than sweet, I guess.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was reading your blog at Earth Rider, which is the name of your new brewery that you're going to start here in Superior.
Yeah.
And you said you source the finest ingredients. And I'm curious, like, what that means and how you do that, because I don't know anything about craft brewing.
It's just like making soup. What you put in is what you're going to get out. If it's really good ingredients, you're going to get really good soup. And beer is the exact same way. One thing we do is we go out to the hop fields. Traditionally, that's been on the in Yakima Valley. And selected our hops specifically, are the lots, the field that we're going to purchase to put into our beer. And it's really amazing how even the same hop variety will be different from field to field. So we'll select which ones we think will fit our our flavor profiles that we're seeking the best, whether that be citrusy or is it more, you know, there are flavors to try to stay away from, and that some hops can put off a garlicky taste or little onions, but we, you know, sometimes you want a little of that. So as we select the grains, the malts have been pretty traditional. There's different, of course, there's different malt varieties as well. So selecting what we use as far as the malt itself and then the roast. A darker beer uses a more roasted malt. It's like coffee beans.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and is it just kind of trial and error then over the years you find out what makes a good mix and what doesn't?
Yeah, that, and then also what the consumer of the beverage is looking for. And like I said, that's evolved over the last 20-some years that I've been in the beer business.
So any tips and tricks then for, you know, like the home brewers out there? You know, I've had some craft brewed beer before, and I'm curious, how do you do it without paying for it later on, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Well, brewing is it's a science and an art. It's a craft for that reason. So it's something that you never cease learning to do. You know, brewing isn't exactly it's not what I went to school for. I'm on the business side of things, and I do brew. But the brew masters, who that's all they think about is flavor profiles and how that beer will transfer from the wort all the way to the glass. That's what they think about all the time. But I think that what I would say is just keep learning, keep trying, keep experimenting, try different things, talk to people that are doing it all the time. The cool thing about craft beer, it's a very sharing community. People in the industry and in the pastime of homebrewing are very eager to share what they know and help out. It's an exciting thing for everybody that's involved, it seems.
So tell me a little bit then about BevCraft, this business incubator that you have.
Sure.
With your four partners, or is it three partners, and the projects that you have going then.
Yeah. Well, when I sold my stake in the brewpub business, my goal is to help, independent brewer that's getting into the industry or has been in for probably a short amount of time, and keep them sustainable. Independent brewing is not an easy business to be in. It's has a lot of sex appeal, but it's also a lot of long hours, hard work, sweaty work, heavy lifting, and it's also very competitive. The beer business is highly competitive, and it's getting more competitive all the time as the big brewers get into it. When I say the big brewers, I mean Anheuser-Busch, MillerCoors are buying up small breweries, independent breweries. So what BevCraft is there to do is to help those brewers who want to do it at a certain level. And we're not there to help everybody because we only have so much bandwidth in our organization, but we're there to get a group of like-minded people that really care about the craft and the quality. And then how do we make that sustainable so they can stay in business ongoing forever? You know, once you build a community around, what I call it is building beer around community, I should say. You know, it's like beer is built for the community that you're in. And we're seeing that more and more all the time as I think the relocalization and the hyper-localization of beer production continues to happen.
So why did you decide that you wanted to locate Earth Rider in Superior?
I drove around a lot around here. And to bring it way back to the beginning, my great-grandfather immigrated here in the middle late 1800s and opened up a bakery. That's been part of our family, Nelson family lore, forever. Great-grandpa Nikolai had a bakery on Banks Avenue. It's called the Imperial Bakery, and then my great-uncles ran it after that into the early 1900s. So that's been kind of cool. I've felt a connection to Superior throughout my life because of that. I went to school at UMD, so I was in the Twin Ports, you know, ongoing. Superior was always a fun place to visit as a person who liked to party.
And so you spent a lot of time on Tower Avenue?
A lot of Tower Avenue action, especially about midnight. We got to go across the bridge. It's time. So that was pre-Minnesota going to 2 a.m. So that was part of it. And then, you know, Wisconsin's a very beer-friendly state. They've helped the brewers in general, and the laws are advantageous for what we want to do over here. Although Minnesota is evolving quickly, and they're both coming on strong.
So what is it exactly that you want to do over here? It's about a $2.5 million project, and it's going to be located near Cedar Lounge.
Yeah, it's we're operating the Cedar Lounge currently as a tavern, doing some cool music events with local musicians. We're recording for a record to come out, compilation record to come out with after a year. We do one every Wednesday. We do some cool music, and then we record it. So that's a big part of what we do. Across Ogden Avenue from the Cedar is the Lehman Mercantile Building, which had been a beer wholesaler in the area. And the Clark family sold out their beer brands to other local wholesalers in July last year, 2016, and the building became available. And it's just right adjacent to our property. And previous to that, we had been planning new construction. And when that building became available, we saw a real great opportunity to utilize something that was already there. It has coolers and floor drains and big warehouse space, big giant overhead doors, loading docks. It's really set up nicely to put in a small brewery. We postponed the project for a year, and while we got everything else to kind of shift our thinking and our financing over to already existing structure. Yeah, Superior is going to be a really great place to do these brewing activities. I'm excited for it. The university here is a huge attraction, I think, for the brewery. We've talked with the chancellor about brewing program possibly coming in and at least helping us facilitate. That's not a done deal, but it's something that we're working on. Superior doesn't have a packaging brewery, has a brew pub, Thirsty Pagan, who does an awesome job, but you can only get their beer there. We want to service the northwestern region of Wisconsin. So it's just the perfect location.
And so you're hoping to start construction this spring on Earth Rider?
You know, the plan is we're working with the Wisconsin Economic Development. We're waiting for one little piece of the puzzle to fall into place. But the plan as of now is to begin, I mean, really it was to begin Monday. So we're waiting to hear if we can or not. So we can't start construction until we hear from them on some financing pieces. The equipment's scheduled to drop August 1st. So no matter what, we're going to make sure that's set to happen. We have to have a lot of things done before then.
And so what's your goal to start off with? What are you hoping to produce?
You know, our goal is to really brew a lot of cool things. My background has been in the pub arena, where we brewed all our own beers for 32 different tap lines around in our own restaurants, and gave us the opportunity, 10 barrels at a time, so it gave us the opportunity to really be diverse in our portfolio. And we're not oversizing our system. It's a 20 barrel system, so 40 kegs at a time, and I believe that we'll be able to brew often enough to have a diversity in our lineup. So we'll start, of course, with some really tasty, an IPA and, you know, probably a stout and some really, you know, good things, and then be able to riff off of those beginning stages and see what exact recipes really resonate with our customers and see what ones they like. And once that happens, after a few months, then we'll start packaging in cans, and it'll go to the local liquor stores as well. So first draft only, some key accounts that we have good relationships with, have good clean beer lines and are excited about our beer and supporting us. And once we know that we can service them at a high level, then we can move on and start servicing some other people that, you know, we don't want to have more than we can chew. We really want to do a good job with whatever we take on.
I guess that kind of maybe answers my next question. If you've got other projects in the works that you're looking to do, whether it's now or in the future.
BevCraft, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, BevCraft will be, we're working on another project right now in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. So that one is probably close to being financed, and we'll, you know, begin construction this summer if everything goes all right. So that'll be the third one. And there's some others that we're talking to, but we're being very selective with our energies.
Don't want to spread yourself too
thin. We don't. We want to do a good job. Let's say that again.
Yeah. Well, anything else that I'm missing that you want people to know about Earth Rider or your plans?
Earth Rider is going to be super cool. It's the Twin Ports will define it, and hopefully we help define the Twin Ports, you know, in certain circles at least. We're right underneath the High Bridge, the Blatnik Bridge, right next to the grain elevators on the far north end of Tower Avenue. And the trains go right behind our property, and they're blowing their whistles all day, and the ships are coming in and out. And really feels cool to be a part of the working harbor. You know, what really built this place, I guess. It's really neat to be down there.
Well, my last question for you is just, what's your favorite local beer right now, and then your favorite beer?
All right, fair enough. There's three breweries that are packaging right now that are doing really great work, and that's it's Bent Paddle, Blacklist, and Castle Danger. And all three of those breweries are doing great. I like the Blacklist Hors de Belgique. I like the Bent Paddle Black and Castle Danger Cream Ale are all fantastic choices out there. My favorite beer overall ever? Well, that's a big one. You know, I think it's Augustiner Edelstoff. It's a German-made beer. It's imported. And so if I was to have a fresh one in Germany or anywhere, I'd have to be in Munich. But I'd be drinking that right now.
Out of the boot or just?
Possibly, depending on what number of it is. Yeah, Oktoberfest did that to me one year. Yeah, it was a very fun time. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your plans, and best of luck to you with Earth Rider.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Again, you were just listening to Tim Nelson about his plans for Earth Rider Brewing Company in Superior. South Shore Brewery in Ashland was the seventh microbrewery to open up in Wisconsin back in the mid-90s, and owner Bo Bellinger spoke with me over the phone yesterday afternoon about his love for craft brewing.
I suppose I was hooked by the allure of the burgeoning industry. I'm a biology and chemistry and math student, basically graduated from Northland College. I was working for the fisheries department of the natural resources, the Wisconsin DNR Fish Management. So I was on Lake Superior for 14 seasons. And I don't know, just got a little bit postal with my civil service job is how I basically frame it in all the other discussions. So I didn't want to move away from the area, and I decided that livelihood was something I wanted to explore. There was a gentleman that opened up a restaurant that included a brew pub in the restaurant. I basically knocked on his door and told him that he'd love to have the chance to be his brewer. That worked out. And in 2004, I was able to buy the brewery from him and still marching on.
And so, you know, what about craft brewing excites you about it? I mean, like, why go into that?
Wow. First of all, you got to like beer. So,
kind of a requirement, huh?
Kind of a requirement. And, to me, it's a marriage of science and art. And I was always fascinated by chemistry and biology and stuff like that. So even through Northland College, there might have been things that, that basically helped me kind of go in that way. My grandfather was a pretty big influence. My grandfather was from rural northwest Indiana, a little town called Schererville. We would go from our harvest trips from Detroit, where I grew up, to my mom's home of Schererville, Indiana. And we'd put up, the harvest every fall. So we're there, doing tomatoes and beans and corn. And Grandpa always had something going, man. Always had something. Wine, he had grapevines, pear trees, cherry trees, you name it. And if there was sugar in it, he probably wasn't making a lot of jam. He was probably making other things out of these fruits and sugar-based stuff. So that sort of caught on with me as far as that whole kind of fermentation and, making booze.
How did your first brew turn out?
Our first beers were widely accepted. I had been brewing by the time 95 came around. Boy, I had been home brewing for, 10, 12 years by then. So we were well advanced in the stages of home brewing. And I had an audience built up from other jobs that I was doing. So I was a bartender here locally, so I was able to, test my wares on the customer, so to speak. I just kept on, hitting the homebrew kind of stuff. But when the opportunity arose to become a professional, I jumped at it as well.
Well, and you've been very successful at it in the Ashland area.
Success is relative. We've been able to survive. We're from a very, very small town, so the hardest part for us is, of course, getting our product to market. And, that's just the hardest part of our job is making sure we can become profitable at, you know, trying to reach Madison or reach Milwaukee or reach the Twin Cities. And all the same time, of course, trying to make sure that we do right by our locals here. So it's not easy. And we do a few things different to help us survive. And I don't know, if you keep on making good beer, I think that's probably where you get the most kind of fans from. So yes, we've been fortunate to have a couple recipes that have won the hearts of some of the consumers. And so, well, we're well established, and that doesn't hurt in this day and age, but it's very, very competitive out there. It's a farmer-like existence. You know, you get up early. There's a lot of physicality in the job. And so, yeah, you're exhausted at the end of the day. It's you know, besides, I'm almost 60. So I've had my run at it. And so, yeah, it's got a physical kind of component to it, and it can command a lot out of you.
So are you still eyeing expanding in Washburn?
We have completed that expansion to a certain degree. So we are brewing in a production facility that we stuck in an old bowling alley in Washburn. So, yes, we have a tap house or a tap room, much like everybody else does, or a tasting room, and a production facility where we do all of our packaging of our year-round products. We still are operating the brewery in the restaurant in Ashland and producing product for Mark Gutter and the Deepwater Grill. So that relationship still continues, but like I said, we were packaging in the basement of that facility and very, very ineffective, very, very labor intensive, and we weren't being competitive at all in the market. So we took on the challenge in late 2012, but pretty much since 2013, we've been after this kind of project, and we finally brewed our first batches of beer late November of last year. So it took me that 2+ years to get our stuff together here.
So what are you looking at for plans for the future? Do you have anything else that you really want to accomplish as far as your beer bucket list?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think we're getting there, too. You're going to help me, and I'm glad you called. I don't know why I can't get this message out there to beer consumers or just buying local or that kind of stuff. It's been not a fad, but it's been a phenomenon now for a good 10 years maybe, the decades worth. We've taken it one step further. Just because it's local doesn't mean it's good. You know, we've always had that adage. All the base malt we use in all of our beers, we grow through the cooperation of some local farmers here. It first started on my own property. We grew barley on my own property with the foreseeable kind of end point being that I wanted to say something about where I live, and one of the best ways to do it is through the ingredients that are in your beer, right? Everybody always says they only use the finest ingredients in beer, but all my craft brewing friends, bless their hearts, they all shop at the same store. I mean, it's not like the barley that somebody's getting is different than somebody else. They're all buying it from Brees, or they're buying it in bulk from the same people. So it's all come from Idaho, you know what I mean? So we wanted to say something about where we live. And up north, this is small grain territory. We can't grow corn because our season is too short. And so we've been an economic kind of contributor to our neighborhood to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars because like you said, we've started these projects. We make high-quality ingredients, and we use them in all our year-round products. All the hops in my beers now come from farms that we started in Wausau and Washolt and Amherst. So we are totally sort of like vertically integrated with the kind of agriculture of our state. The people that are doing this for us right now are true professionals, and I'm such a small brewery that I don't think I was really high enough on the food chain from all the other purveyors, right? When I first started, you know, I was probably one of 400 breweries in the nation. Now there's probably 3,200 breweries in the nation. So my connections to fresh hops have diminished. My ability to get the best of the best is, you know, I've dropped down that kind of ladder of who gets what and where. You know, we're such a small purchaser, we couldn't get a price point. What's fun about my project is that not only have we been putting the money that we, you know, so when we buy barley, it goes right to a farmer in Mason. You know, that big payment of barley is significant for them. It's a tractor payment. Plus, that money stays right here in our county. The other thing is that it's one of a kind. It's not what the masses are consuming in their beers. It basically is a unique variety of barley that grows well in our area. It grows specifically really well in our area, and we make damn good beer out of it. And like I said, I think our product is starting to say something a little bit more about where we live and where it comes from, instead of just being craft beer. Just, that's what we're trying to more or less say when we do all these things.
That it's not just, you know, local from the state. It's right from your own backyard.
Right.
Well, my last question for you, Bo, would be the same as what I asked Tim earlier, which is, what's your favorite local beer and what's your favorite beer?
You're talking something other than South Shore, I would imagine.
Yeah, you can say your own is your favorite.
We make a Pilsner. The Inland Sea Pilsner from South Shore Brewery is, you know, not enough people know about it. But like I said, we were talking about our base malt. That's 92% of our base malt. Most beers, because they got colored, that's where you get some of the specialty malts. We don't do the specialty malts. We buy the specialty malts because we don't have a roaster. It's just too small of a purchase for us to get involved with that. Plus, that's a whole other kind of learning curve. So the more color that's in beer, the more specialty malts in it. But our Pilsner are straw colored, and it's 92% of our base malt. It is delicious. It's one of the hardest beers we make. It really is something that I enjoy more than I probably should. So that's way up there. And then, you know what? Beer is a fresh product. And my taste buds change just like the seasons do. And, you know, that's what's so fun about discovering and beer in general, is that you're always looking to be surprised. You're always looking for the wow factor in every new craft beer that you drink. Beer is just favorite. And if I had my favorite beer to every day, it would be my Pilsner.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about your operation, Bo, and what you've done over the years. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks for reaching out.
Again, that was Bo Bellinger, owner of South Shore Brewery in Ashland. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear from the DNT's education reporter, Jana Hollingsworth, about a community group that formed to address equity concerns between Duluth, Denfeld, and East High Schools. Plus, later in the hour, we'll kick off a series of original pieces about the dark side from this year's Writers' Read event in Ashland. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out. Welcome back. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. Up next, we hear from the Duluth News Tribune's education reporter, Jana Hollingsworth. She covered a story this week about a newly formed community group that is addressing concerns with equity between Duluth's Denfeld and East High Schools. And she spoke with me the other day by phone about that story. Jana, you covered a story this week about the Duluth School District and an issue that's come up for parents and educators. They've formed a community group, is my understanding, and they're looking at some recommendations of how to improve equity between Denfeld High School and Duluth East High School. Could you just speak a little bit then to the differences that have drawn the ire of parents between Denfeld High School students and Duluth East, related to, say, the graduation rates and issues with minority students?
Sure. Well, the two high schools have pretty different profiles. East, of course, has about 500 more students than Denfeld. It has a 94% graduation rate. Less than 10% of its students receive special education services, and less than 20% take part in the federal free and reduced price lunch program, whereas Denfeld has a 76% graduation rate. More than a quarter of its students receive special education services, and more than half take part in that free and reduced price lunch program. And Denfeld's dropout rate is 12%. East is, I think, about 2%. East has about 11% students of color, while Denfeld has 25%. And if you want to break down graduation rates amongst a couple of different groups, East Black students is about 78% graduation rate, but only 3% of the school is made up of Black students. As far as Native American students, the graduation rate, the cohort is too small, so it's not counted. It's only about 1% of the school. And then when you go to Denfeld, the Native American graduation rate is 48%, with the other half, they're either continuing in school to maybe graduate in 5 years or 6 years, or dropping out. As far as Black students, 52% graduation rate with a 33% dropout rate. And again, small number of the school, 8% of Denfeld's enrollment is Black students, and about 6% is Native American students. So just to give you a little context, it's not, they're much smaller groups. So those numbers look alarming and are alarming, but it's a smaller number than, say, white students.
And so what were some of the recommendations that this group laid out, and who are they?
The group is a combination of parents and educators, people who are, you know, stakeholders within Denfeld, some guidance counselors. And they started meeting this winter when one thing related to equity sort of became a recurring theme that was talked about this fall regarding access to advanced classes, where students at Denfeld were not having as much opportunity to take a high-level class. Like, they were only offering one option throughout the day, and if it was offered at the same time as another high-level class, then they would have to choose. And East was not having the same problem. And this is related to the enrollment at Denfeld High School. So that's why the group formed. And it's been meeting and gathering input from the community on, you know, what are Denfeld's needs? What would help sort of level the playing field between the two high schools? And last week they presented a report to the school board. And there were 12 issues they had pinpointed, and then they had sort of long-term and short-term fixes for all of those things that they were suggesting to the Duluth School District. But they had four priorities. One of those was obviously providing more access to advanced courses at Denfeld, and they had ideas on how to do that. Another was reducing suspensions for students of color and increasing graduation rates for students of color and low-income students. Another priority was providing transportation to Denfeld students who live within the 2 mile radius. Right now, for high school students, if they live outside the 2 mile radius, they get transportation. If you live within it, you don't. And so they're saying it could improve attendance if busing or DTA passes or what have you are given to those students who live within the 2 mile radius. And the last thing was rethinking how a type of state funding geared towards the level of low-income students at schools is distributed. Currently, 50% of this amount that's related to the number of free and reduced-price lunch students at a school is kept within the school, and 50% can legally be moved. And they're saying maybe that shouldn't happen.
And keep that funding at Denfeld High School because they have more needs than, say, Duluth East.
Right. Some of the money gets taken from Denfeld, and it's used. And this happens at all of the schools. They get to keep 50% of it, and then some of it's moved around to lower class sizes district-wide. And this group is saying, well, the intent of the law is to help underachieving students, help lower the achievement gap. And so they're saying there should be an effort to find a different source of funding to lower class sizes and leave this one pot of money alone.
And one of those proposed ideas would be to, raise the levy. Is that right?
That is an idea. The current operating levy expires at the end of 2018. And so I would assume the district would certainly go out to renew that again, if not increase it. And going with the whole lowering class size idea, that would probably be a likely ask. That would be something that the district would look to do. And the group is, some group members, I don't know if they're all on board with this, they're saying that that would be a good way to fix that whole funding issue.
So what are the next steps then for this community group?
I believe that a committee of the whole meeting will be set up with the school board before the end of the school year, and the group that put together the proposal will meet with the board and they'll offer their recommendations. And I know that in the meantime, the district officials are looking into what's been proposed and seeing what's feasible, what's not, what certain things would cost, what's not affordable. And that's something that the board has asked district administration to do.
Again, that was Jana Hollingsworth, education reporter for the Duluth News Tribune, talking about a newly formed community group addressing concerns with equity in Duluth schools. This week, we kick off a series of original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work was part of the 7th annual Writers Read event in Ashland. Each year, a group of writers organizes a public reading of the best submissions from talent living throughout the region. And this year, people submitted their best works on the theme of the dark side. We bring you one of those stories by Janet Christie of Gurnee. She shared her story before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland about the darker side of babysitting. Christie says her story rings true.
Because you can't make this stuff up. To preface this reading, I'd like to say that I never imagined sharing this with the public. I try to be a good person, someone who loves her family members and does her best to make them feel that they are cared for. Sometimes, however, things just happen and it's not anybody's fault. I'm not proud of what I'm going to be reading here. Mostly I'm hoping that you listen with empathy to my side of the events that follow. You can then judge me as you see fit. The stunning winter sky and welcome sunshine of a cold mid-March morning follow endless dreary days. During the long winter, sky is gray, trees are dusky, and snow a shade of pearl. Today, brilliant cerulean blue beckons us outdoors. Away from the packed down trails, the snow still measures 2 feet deep. We, however, are a determined threesome. 1 5-year-old grandson, 1 almost 2, and 1 grandma in charge for the morning. It takes 15 minutes to outfit the 2 boys for outdoors. Bibbed snow pants tucked into boots, snowboarding jacket, neck warmer, chromer hat, and mitts for the older boy. Full snowsuit, fleece cap, mini neck warmer, mitts so hard to get on bendy tiny fingers, and boots for the toddler. I quickly dress in my own outdoor clothing, hurrying, because little boys get hot and cranky really fast. But we grandmas plan for that. I open the sliding glass door and the 5-year-old flies down the steps into the deep snow, snagging a blue plastic sled on his way. He knows where we are heading and will not wait for his grandma and little brother. Our plans are to go downhill toward the creek, cross it, and hike up the opposite side in order to sled back down again. My older grandson turns toward me and hollers up, "Grandma, can't you go faster? Leave that dumb little kid in the house." We could sled down to the creek without him. The little guy with very short legs has to settle for me pulling him on another sled. We are moving downhill toward the lowest part of the 40 acres, our beautiful creek. The 5-year-old has no problem negotiating the snowshoe trail. I, on the other hand, am having lots of trouble pulling the little kid on the sled. The sled, wider than the packed trail, slides on an angle. The toddler slips off the slippery surface 3 times on the short way to the creek. Older brother yells from below, "I'm not waiting for you guys. I'm at the creek, and it's pretty deep." That sounds ominous. The 5-year-old is planted in the middle of the creek by the time we arrive. He's up to his knees in running creek water. It's unfortunate that his snow boots only go up to mid-calf. He's not complaining yet, and the water's only 1 inch or so over his boots. I figure that's his bad. He could have just as easily crossed over on the bridge. He remarks, "I never walked in the creek in the winter. I always go barefoot in the summer. Wonder what mittens feel like underwater." Oof-da. The bridge across the shallow 8-foot-wide stream is constructed of 2 12-inch oak planks. Snowshoe and cross-country ski traffic has packed the bridge's crust into a narrow, icy pyramid less than 1 foot wide. Big Brother intently watches his mittens soak up creek water in the center of the flowing stream. Now both his hands and his feet are drenched with ice water, and I wonder how long this excursion can last before he gets frostbite. It's been all of maybe 4 minutes. I hunker down in front of the sled and make eye contact with my excited toddler passenger. Clamping his hands on the sled, I say directly to eyes that are the same color as today's sky, "Baby, hang on tight," and I make ready to cross the short bridge over the creek. I bend over, stabilizing the slippery sled, hands on both plastic edges, and begin to move backwards on the angled ledges of the bridge. Baby step by baby step, the two of us inch successfully to the center of the bridge. The high points of the stream's tiny waves reflect today's brilliant sunshine with eye-catching bling. 6 inches of ice water bubbles and bounces off moss-colored rocks, and stones glitter from the bottom. My tiny passenger exhibits happy, interested concentration in the sparkling water flowing next to and below him. He decides at that point to crank his large, heavy toddler head over the edge of the sled to check things out very closely from the bottom of the creek looking up. "It happened so fast, officer," is my initial thought. Fuzzy-hatted and headfirst, he topples into the shallow creek, his bulkily dressed body following. I leap into the water and right him by pulling him out by the butt of his snowsuit. His sputtering mouth makes sucking sounds as he catches his breath. Then he commences to howling as his insulated winter gear sops up every possible drop of creek water. The child, formerly known as interested and happy, is now thoroughly pissed off. And Big Brother whines, "How come he gets to go swimming and I don't?" I begin to trundle the victim's waterlogged heavy body from the creek back up to the warmth of the wood fire in the house. I'm trying to move quickly to ward off having to explain a toeless and fingerless child to the parents. I turn to holler at the older kid, still busy washing his mittens. "Bring both of the sleds. We have to get your little brother back up to the house and warm as fast as we can." Big Brother yells, "Now you want to go fast." But it's very slow going. The toddler and I are going uphill through deep snow, and he is wet, wiggling, and screaming, and my sorrel boots are waterlogged. Big Brother, whose only responsibility is to haul up the two sleds, finds it not so easy to fly uphill. "Grandma, slow down, don't leave me." He expends a lot of energy cataloging my transgressions all the way to the house. "Grandma, you're ditching me. We were supposed to go sledding." Stupid butthead little brother. I have to bring his sled too. Now we gotta go in the house just because of him. "You're gonna make us read books." I'm telling Dad and Mom. Having climbed up the steep steps to our home, I dump the soggy, wailing toddler on the rug inside the door. I am as close to a heart attack as I have ever been. Of course, by the time the parents come to fetch the boys, the older twit, not wanting to be outdone in adventures by his goofy little brother, happily races to meet the unsuspecting folks at the door with, "Hey, Grandma dumped both of us in the deep creek, and then she left me down there all by myself. And I was all wet, and she wouldn't even wait for me." The mean little troll of a toddler in dry clothes and a new diaper, holding a homemade chocolate chip cookie, no less, waddles up to give them his 2 cents of the tragedy. He doesn't talk yet, but he does a pretty good job of pantomiming the entire episode, complete with visuals of Grandma purposefully throwing him into the creek and then pulling him out by his hair. I may never babysit these two again. I may never be asked to babysit these two again.
Writers Read is an annual event that is produced by Northland College in partnership with Wisconsin Public Radio and Aqueous Magazine. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll have news of the week as covered by Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio, and this is the news of the week as covered by the Superior Bureau of Wisconsin Public Radio. Superior's mayor called for the resignation of a Superior City Councilor who was facing criminal charges after pointing a loaded gun at his fiancée. Superior Mayor Jim Payne says he's shocked and outraged at the charges facing Superior City Councilor Graham Garfield. Garfield faces three misdemeanor charges and one felony charge of reckless endangerment. Payne says he's demanding Garfield's resignation or removal from the Superior City Council.
If you are charged with a felony and looking at potentially months in court to resolve said felony and are unable to attend to your duties, then I don't think you can effectively represent your constituents.
Payne says everyone makes mistakes, but Superior's mayor says the charges against Garfield are very serious.
It is important that we do not minimize the severity of this situation, nor attempt to simply move on. There is a victim here. That person cannot minimize what happened.
Attempts to reach Garfield and his fiance were unsuccessful. Garfield was recently re-elected to the city council by one vote. A recall election can't occur until 1 year after taking office. A preliminary hearing for Garfield is scheduled for May 3rd. Fraser Shipyards will pay a fine and make safety improvements in a settlement reached with the Federal Workers Safety Agency after a man died from severe burns this month. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, issued a roughly $12,000 fine to the Superior Shipyard last month after employee Joe Birch was severely burned on the job this winter. Fraser issued a release today saying the shipyard will now require all workers to wear fire-retardant suits in hot work environments. The Federal Workers Safety Agency and Fraser also agreed to a lesser fine of about $7,500. The shipyard also says OSHA will not issue a finding of any wrongdoing against Fraser in the incident. Birch died as a result of his injuries on April 8th. He had worked at the Northern Wisconsin Shipyard for 22 years. The Black Student Union at UW-Superior is holding its final Friday event tomorrow evening. Black Student Union President DeAndre Robinson says the event is meant to educate people about different cultures and promote diversity.
We get together and we have cultural foods. And then we have discussions about cultures within the African diaspora. And tomorrow there will be a presentation on Ethiopia.
Robinson says the event is an opportunity to learn about current events and history surrounding people of color. He says they partnered with the Duluth and Superior Police Departments to hold the event. Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander says they wanted to take part for a variety of reasons.
The primary one is to build trust, but the second one, too, is to, you know, hopefully generate interest in our police department for diverse candidates to want to come and consider a career working here.
On that note, Chief Alexander says the department will swear in its first African-American police officer next month. The Final Friday event will kick off tomorrow evening at 5:30 at Pilgrim Lutheran Church in Superior. The Black Student Union will serve soul food as well as dishes from the Caribbean and Cameroon. The event is free and all are welcome to attend. The town of Sanborn's Board of Review met earlier this week to notify tribal residents that their land will likely be put back on the tax roll. A group of residents filed a lawsuit on behalf of Ashland County taxpayers against the Sanborn Town Board last fall. The town passed a resolution 10 years ago that removed about $15 million worth of property value after a federal court in Michigan ruled properties within reservation boundaries were not subject to taxation. A Sawyer County judge ruled earlier this year that the town's tribal members were not exempt from taxation. Attorney Linda Coleman says land owned by tribal members will once again be taxed unless properties are deemed exempt under rules set by the Wisconsin Department of Revenue.
Due to certain language in the Treaty of 1854, real property located within the reservation boundary of Bad River, Lac Qui Ray, Lac de Flambeau, and Red Cliff is exempt if One is that it was allotted before February 8, 1887 under the treaty. Two is that it's owned in fee simple by the tribe or tribal members. And three, there has been no conveyance of the land to non-tribal members.
Coleman says the properties in question were taxed prior to the town's resolution. An attorney representing tribal members says the burden should rest on the town of Sanborn to prove why tribal members' properties should be taxed. The town's assessor is reevaluating taxable lands, and information on the 2017 tax bill for residents will go out this fall. The St. Louis River Alliance is holding an event this weekend to educate beachgoers on efforts to restore an endangered shore bird along Lake Superior. Program manager Alyssa Hoppe says the small sandy-colored piping plover migrate every year from the southern shoreline of the Atlantic coast to the Great Lakes.
In 86, they were designated as critically endangered. Their populations and breeding pairs diminished greatly. And so since 87, we've been working in the Great Lakes region to restore nesting habitat and bring them back and increase the population.
Hoppe says 17 nesting pairs have been found in the Great Lakes region over the last couple of years. She says their goal is to grow that number to 150. Hoppe says they're hoping beachgoers will help them with that.
Keeping dogs on leashes is actually one of the most important things. Disturbances coming from animals and humans are one of the biggest deterrents from creating nesting habitats. Also, keeping beaches clean of debris and garbage is very helpful.
She says they'll have law enforcement patrolling Minnesota Point when the bird is most likely to nest from May to mid-June. The St. Louis River Alliance will meet with those interested in volunteering at the Pavilion by the Beach House on Saturday at 11 a.m. And that's the news of the week as covered by the Superior Bureau of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can hear this program and other news stories on our website at wpr.org/superior. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out. We hope to have you with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.